Okay, today, entirely for all day today, all of our quantum dynamics are uniform dynamics. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. Okay, so what's in the what are the elements of this Schrodinger picture? And the first one is that observable quantities like position and momentum are not themselves time dependent necessarily. We're sort of restricting our attention to those that aren't. So observables are constant over time, but the quantum state, evolves in time. The state evolves in time. The state evolves in time. And we have how that works. Psi is this unitary operator that depends on the elapsed time times some initial, or acting on some initial state. And if you like, we can phrase this in terms of an equation of motion, which is the Schrodinger equation. The equation of motion is an equation about the quantum state that describes how it evolves at each instant in time. And that's, of course, just that H acting on the state is I h bar times the time derivative of that state. That's our equation of motion, the Schrodinger equation. And there's some things to note about this. First of all, I want to note that the Schrodinger equation is really an equation about the time evolution operator, because that's the only part of psi which really depends on time. It's the time evolution operator acting on this. So I could really write the Schrodinger equation as h acting on u is equal to, or h times u is I h bar times the derivative of u with respect to t. That's the same equation as this one, given that the evolution is described by this time evolution operator. If I act on the same initial state psi naught on both sides, you see I get the Schrodinger equation. The other thing is that because our dynamics is uniform, the Hamiltonian operator has the same eigenstates as the stationary states of the evolution, and so this thing is the same as UH. H and U commute with each other for any time. What else do I want to point out? Oh yeah, there's the there was also how we might think about expectation values. The expectation of a particular observable quantity is, of course, this inner product, and that depends on time. The expectation of an observable expectation value depends on time, and in fact, I can sort of show you how that depends on time by explicitly writing the time dependence of the psi state in terms of these operators. Okay, so here's all stuff that should make sense from last time. And of course, the reason that I paint this picture kind of all in one place over here is that today we're going to paint a new picture for the first few minutes of class here. We're going to paint another picture, which is the Heisenberg picture. historically, this is several months older than that picture, since Heisenberg came up with his version of quantum mechanics in 1925, and Schrodinger didn't write down his wave equation until 1926. So, well, this is actually getting back to our quantum mechanical roots here. And the Heisenberg picture which we'll indicate by putting hats on everything is just the opposite of this. In the Heisenberg picture, the state is time independent. The Heisenberg picture state, psi hat, is just the initial state of the system. It's time independent. Because what is a state? Well, a state is sort of a description of how the system was prepared. It's encoded in some cool way, but it really tells you how the system is prepared, and as time evolves, it doesn't change how the system is prepared. So intuitively, this kind of makes sense. The state doesn't change. But the observables do change. The observables evolve in time. So the observable A is A hat, which is a function of time. The thing representing position, for example, would be an operator that is time dependent. How should it do this? Well, this piece of math gives us the clue that we can take the operator that sits inside this inner product to be our definition of a time dependent operator describing A. So A is U dagger, which is a function of time, A, U, function of time. So we're imagining here that all of the time dependence in the system, all the time evolution, is happening to the observables. Now, notice that the expectation value of A, the expectation value of this quantity, which I said depended on time, is exactly psi hat, A hat, psi hat. So the Heisenberg picture will predict the same expectations of all observables as a function of time. You'll get all the same statistical predictions from the theory, but it's a very different view. It says the state is constant. It's the observables, the operators themselves, that are evolving in time. Let me note something about the Hamiltonian operator. H hat is, of course, U dagger H U. But since H U is the same as U H, that's U dagger U times H, which is just equal to H. So the Hamiltonian operator in the Heisenberg picture is just the same as before, and it is time independent in the case of uniform dynamics. But other operators will change, will evolve in time. And so in order to get at this, I want to dig a little deeper into this. One thing I want to tell you about the Heisenberg picture is that it preserves all of the algebraic relations between operators. It's pretty clear that if operator C is equal to operator A plus operator B, that implies that C hat is equal to A hat plus B hat, right?
And if I just transform everything like this, this is a linear machine that changes A into A hat. But it's also the case, let's suppose that C is equal to A times B. Well, then what's C hat? Well, C hat is U dagger C U which is U dagger AB, U, which is, well, I can put the identity between A and B, and I can write the identity in a useful way. So that's U dagger A U, U dagger B U, which is just A hat B hat. So if the operator C is the product of operators A and B, then if I look at the Heisenberg picture, the same mathematical relation is holds among their time evolving forms. And this means, for example, that all commutation relations between the time evolving Heisenberg operators will be just the same as the commutation relations in the Schrodinger picture. Okay? So this is a useful fact. All these algebraic relations will be the same. Okay, so let's work out the equation of motion in the Heisenberg picture. Now, the equation of motion won't be an equation about the state. The state is time independent. The equation of motion will be an equation satisfied by the time-dependent observables. So what is the derivative with respect to time of A hat? What's the derivative with respect to time of A hat? Well, that's the derivative with respect to time of U dagger AU. A itself, we'll assume, does not depend on time explicitly, that the Schrodinger picture operator is some constant operator like position of the particle or something. And then that means we'll just get two terms here. One of them is du by dt dagger AU, and the other is U dagger A du by dt. Of course, we have the Schrodinger equation, which tells me the relationship between the Hamiltonian operator and the time derivative of the U operator. This is the same U operator as we had before, and so this is, let's see, this guy will be right. 1 over I h bar u h dagger a u plus u dagger a 1 over I h bar h u. I've used, by the way, my freedom to write u h or h u either way I want. Do I really want that freedom? No, I don't want that freedom. I'll write it the same. Let's see. H U. I don't care. That's fine. Okay, so let's write what these things are. I take all the daggers, and I get minus 1 over, well, let's take out a factor of 1 over I H bar. Here I'll have minus U dagger H A U, and here I'll have U dagger A H U, and that's just 1 over I H bar times U dagger commutator of A with H U. But this is sort of the Heisenbergization of the commutator of these two operators. But of course, we said that commutators are the same in the Heisenberg picture and in the Schrodinger picture. And so I can rewrite this whole thing as the derivative with respect to time of a dagger is simply equal to 1 over I h bar times the commutator of a hat and h. And just for fun, I'll write that h hat, although we know that h hat and h are the same. And here it is, the Heisenberg equation of motion. The Heisenberg equation of motion. It may look a little familiar. I hope so. Why? What's familiar about it? What does it remind you of? And the answer may be nothing at all. I have no idea. But some of you, it may remind you of something. Yeah. Correct. The formula that we derive for the derivative of the expectation value. Let me just remind you of that. We found that the derivative with respect to t of the expectation value, 1 over I h bar, sort of an expectation value of the commutator. I hate to call this the expectation value of the commutator because, of course, the commutator of two observables is not an observable, right? The commutator of two Hermitian operators is an anti-Hermitian operator. But, okay, but this is okay. This, we can see, is really telling us about this because the expectations are simply, the expectations involved can be done in the Heisenberg representation where the states themselves, the state involved, does not depend on time. All the time dependence is in the operator. So we can see that this is just as true and it makes just as much sense in the Heisenberg picture as it did before in the Schrodinger picture. It's just that we've changed our view about what's time dependent and what's time independent. So there are a couple of really interesting things that follow from this, and let me just mention a couple of them. So typically, the operator corresponding to an observable at T1, and the operator corresponding to the same observable at T2. Is not equal to zero. Typically, that's not equal to zero. I mean, it's equal to zero. Sometimes it's equal to zero, for example, if A commutes with the Hamiltonian, then the operator A hat is time independent. But in general, this is often not zero. And we know that non-commuting observables correspond to incompatible experimental procedures, complementary experimental procedures. And this kind of makes sense, because the experimental setup you would have to measure A at time T1 is not exactly the same as the experimental setup that you'd have to measure A at time T2. The clock on the apparatus is set a little differently. And you won't necessarily be able to design an experiment that will be able to give you simultaneous exact knowledge of this and this. That is to say, for example, consider a free particle wave packet. If its position is very well defined at T1, its position may be, therefore, very ill-defined at T2 because of the time evolution. And that shows up here as the fact that the position at T1 and the position at T2 will not commute. Let's talk about a particle moving in one dimension. Let's suppose that H is P squared over 2 mu plus V of X. And of course, I'll just put hats over it because this also must be true in the Heisenberg representation. All the algebraic relationships between the operators must be the same. Let's ask the question: what are the Heisenberg equations of motion of the operators x hat and p hat? And we find that the derivative with respect to time of x hat. Well, we actually did this calculation yesterday, didn't we? When we talked about the expectation values of this. Except now, instead of being calculations about the expectation value, we're going to get something for the time-dependent observables themselves. in the Heisenberg picture. And so what did we find? When we did the expectation value, the rate of change of the expectation value position was what? Oh, I don't want to do the calculation again. What? Right, it was the expectation value of momentum divided by the mass. And so the same thing's going to be true here, but for the time-dependent operators, here it's just going to be this. This is the equation of motion for the Heisenberg position operator. Okay, what about the equation of motion for momentum? Well, last time we saw that it was the expectation value of negative derivative of the potential function. But there are no expectation values here. This is just going to be the negative of the derivative of the potential function of the x hat operator. Here we go. Here are the Heisenberg equations of motion for a particle moving in one dimension. Yeah.
So what's the interpretation of that?
Well, okay. So last time we said the equations of motion were just like the classical equations of motion, except there was a difference between a function evaluated at the expectation value and the expectation value of the function. There was just a little bit of difference, and that little bit of difference is why the expected position of the particle didn't always exactly obey the classical equations of motion. Here, we get exactly the classical equations of motion, except the objects that follow these classical equations of motion are operators. They're infinite dimensional matrices. And so this looks simple, but it's not. It contains all the quantum mechanical stuff here. And essentially, the Heisenberg found equations of motion that were classical equations of motion. But the objects that obeyed those equations of motion were extremely non-classical objects. They were matrices, which is why he we think of as operators. Why he his quantum mechanics eventually became called matrix mechanics. And so, not only does this represent, you know, a position of the particle, it represents all possible positions of the particle. And depending on what basis you would write this matrix in, all kinds of off-diagonal matrix elements. There's an awful lot built into these equations of motion. Is that, I don't know if that's helpful.
I was asking, you wrote V prime of x hat.
Oh, V prime of x hat. So V is a function of an operator, and this is the derivative of that function evaluated at this operator. V is given presumably in terms of some power series, which I can take the derivative of. We talked about this last time. We talked about the some commutation relations involving position and momentum. Just briefly. Maybe I'll say a little bit more of that in a minute. Okay, so this is pretty cool. And why would you want to do this? The last thing I want to say about the Heisenberg picture. Why would you want to think this way? Well, it's kind of cool. And it's equivalent. So that may be enough of a justification for you, but there's a really seriously important reason why this is a good way of thinking that you should have in mind and be able to use. And there are actually lots of seriously good reasons. I'll only give you one seriously good reason. And let's just mention in passing quantum field theory. Okay, in quantum field theory, we're going to have some kind of state of the field. So let's think about the Schrodinger picture. We'll have some kind of state of the field, which I'll write this way. Depends on time, the quantum state of the field. And then what about the dynamical variables, the field variables? What are they like? Well,
they are operators, and they represent things like the value of the electric field at this point in space. Okay, the observables are things related to the field values at different points in space. So you have the field variables are something like, I'll call it F for field. They'll be functions of position, typically, because for a quantum field, that field is extended over space, and the value of the electric field depends on position. You'll have different observables for the field corresponding to different locations in space. But notice that this treats time and space in a different way. Another way of putting it is that I have to pick out a particular notion of time, a particular frame of reference, a particular coordinate system, in order to treat the state as time dependent and the field variables as dependent on space. So the Schrodinger picture does not proclaim the relativistic invariance of our theories, but the Heisenberg picture. In the Heisenberg picture, then we'd have our state, which would be timeless. The state would be simply a timeless statement about the physical situation. And the field variables would now have include the time dependence. And so now you can imagine this as being a much more natural candidate for relativistic language. Okay? Space-time language. This is a much more natural way of doing it. So the Heisenberg picture may be more suitable in a relativistic field theory. Okay. That's all I'm going to say about quantum field theory, at least today. Questions? Yeah.
Do you use the interaction picture?
Oh, okay. When you're doing a calculation, you choose which picture you want to use opportunistically. Okay, And we'll talk about the interaction picture, I hope, a little bit later on. And in the interaction picture, you do this trick with almost all of your dynamics and just the little dynamics of some interaction that you leave in a Schrodinger picture. So you have both things going on. You're doing a calculation. That's fine. If you want to prove that your theory is relativistically invariant, you'll need something like the Heisenberg picture. It won't be as obvious in the Schrodinger picture. But the Schrodinger picture, or the interaction picture, or any other kind of picture that separates out one time observable from the others, it may be very practical for calculation. You often pick a coordinate system to do your calculations in, but as a theoretical matter, you know that the results of your calculations, because of the structure of your theory, won't depend on that. I'm not saying this very well. The point I'm making here is not a point about usefulness for calculation. It's a point about what picture will naturally show relativistic invariance. Yeah. That's if you want to think about things in terms of the Hamiltonian. Before the end of the week, we'll be talking about ways of thinking about quantum dynamics that don't depend on the Hamiltonian, but are also better adapted to a relativistically invariant situation. So that's what's called the canonical approach, canonical quantization. Canonical quantization absolutely depends on picking out some time variable. But canonical quantization is not the only game in town. So
It may be a very practical one, but it's not the only one. Other questions? All right. Let's do something else. All right, I'll start erasing over here. Okay, so we've talked about how. Oh, I guess I should make the mention that the thing that may emphasize what I've talked about before. I'm going to adopt the Schrodinger picture mostly. Whenever we switch out of the Schrodinger picture, well, I'll let you know. But the Heisenberg picture is important. It's fundamental. But you have to have one particular language for describing things. I find it a little more intuitive to think of the state of the system is evolving rather than the variables evolving. But everything that you can say in the Schrodinger picture can be said in the Heisenberg picture. And sometimes it's a useful exercise simply to reflect on how that translation would wind up. So Schrodinger picture is our picture from now on today and for most of most of the course. Okay. So we said that the Schrodinger equation was really an equation about the operator, the time evolution operator. I wrote down an equation which sort of looked like this: the derivative with respect to time of u is equal to, I'll just write it this way: minus I over h bar h u. The minus sign comes from the fact that 1 over I is minus I, of course. Okay, so this is the content of the Schrodinger equation, and I note that this has the general form, which is our favorite form for a differential equation, that the derivative with respect to time of something equals a constant times something. And we all know how to solve this differential equation. The differential equation, the solution is, of course, that something as a function of time is equal to something as a function of 0 times e to the constant times time. That's the solution. And of course, the in order to do this, the u is our something. U of 0, of course, is the identity. And so I'll be able to write down u of t is equal to e to the minus I ht over h bar. And that's our solution to the Schrodinger equation. If you know the Hamiltonian, you can then write down the time evolution operator for any time. Of course, what is this exponential, this operator exponential? It's a power series. We define transcendental functions. It's easy to define, not even transcendental functions. We define anything except powers and sums of powers of operators by means of a power series. Because really all we need to know how to do is add operators together, multiply them by scalars, and multiply them together. That's all we know how to do. And everything else we have to build out of that, and we do it by power series. So if you have a function of a scalar variable, which is given by a power series, then we say that the function of an operator is the same kind of power series, where you replace the powers of the variable by powers of the operator. Now, we have to put in the identity here so that the zero order term is a operator too. Yeah.
What happens if h
depends on time?
If x depends on time?
H.
Oh, h. Right, okay. What happens if h depends on time? Okay, so if h depends on time, something this simple won't work. And what you'll have to have here, well, actually, it's quite a bit more complicated, isn't it? It's not sufficient even to have an integral. If h depends on time, I don't know the general way I'd want to write this down if h depends on time. I guess when you have short intervals of time, then the things effectively commute and you can get an integral. That might be partly answered on about Thursday, but yeah, you want to say something?
Wouldn't you have like a time-ordered product of integrals?
Right.
Which something that Nima mentioned in his lectures.
Yes. What you would have is you would think of this as being composed of a very large number of products of terms like this with very short intervals of time. So a time-varying Hamiltonian could be thought of as a bunch of short intervals of time, each of which has a different constant Hamiltonian. And then when you do that, if you want to convert that into the exponential of something up here, you have to take into account the order in which those terms appear. So remember the exponential of a times the exponential of b is not, in general, equal to the exponential of a plus b. So it would not be something quite so simple as all of those exponential terms compacting into a single sum in the exponent, which would turn into an integral in the limit. It's something a little bit more subtle because those things don't commute. And so you have to do as Tibro says, you have to have a time ordered product of things that turns into a time ordered integral. The fact that that's extremely difficult to think about is one of the reasons why we're having uniform dynamics today. So that the Hamiltonian is time independent, because this is a much clearer thing than that. That shows up, by the way, in the interaction picture a lot, because very often in the interaction picture, which is a way of shoving some of the time dependence onto the observables and leaving some of it alone, very often the main part of the Hamiltonian is time independent. But the interaction is the only time dependent part. And so when you find the time evolution operator for the state in the interaction picture, you're often faced with this exact problem of how to do that time order interval. Now, I don't know if that answers your question. It is a complicated answer. Is that helpful? Okay, all right.
I think they'll say it in detail when they go to quantum field theory.
Okay. So. Well, you can't avoid it there. okay, so this is correct. One thing that you might wonder about, yeah.
Can you still define a series like that if those operators A are not bounding?
Aha! Very good. Let's think about A. Let's assume for the moment that A is normal. So let's consider what we have if we have a normal A, which means it has an eigenbasis and eigenvalues. It has a spectral. It has a spectral form. A is I could write it as the sum over n A sub n. N, where the n's are eigenbases for A, and they're and it's an orthonormal basis. Okay, so if I can write something like that, then then when you substitute this in here, you'll find that all of these terms have their diagonal in the same representation. And so you find, if you evaluate this series formally, that FA has the same eigenstates, in, and it has eigenvalues which are simply f of a n. It's simply this power series evaluated at the various eigenvalues. So the key question is, what is the domain of convergence of the power series? Now, some functions, like the exponential, converge over the entire complex plane. So an unbounded operator is no problem, because the entire spectrum of the operator is inside the complex plane. But that's not true for every power series, and so sometimes you have to worry about convergence. Does that answer your question? Right. There are a lot of difficulties with unbounded operators, as you know, clearly. For example, they're not continuous, to handle things like even position and momentum for a particle moving in one dimension in a completely rigorous fashion, you have to do a lot of things that I can't really think of like this. You have to, for example, really, there are no position eigenstates. There aren't any. And so what you have instead of this is you have a spectral measure, which is it's a much more subtle object that plays the role of this. But that means that all of the customary calculations that we do about even a particle moving in one dimension, using things like delta functions and so on to do normalizations and calculations, using improper momentum eigenstates to define wave functions and so on, all of those things have to be justified by a much deeper mathematical structure, which I'm not going to do. I'm not going to go into. I'm going to say this is a you can do such things, and you can justify all of these procedures by treating them as appropriate limits. But the question of how you take those limits and how they converge is extremely delicate. And we have 3 weeks instead of a year, so we're not going to do that. All right. I'm sorry to voice it off, but those are the issues that you have to face. If you have an infinite dimensional space and your operator is a bounded operator, it's therefore continuous, everything is much nicer. But of course, none of the operators that we really care about are bounded. So that's a it's a mathematical challenge to really see how to make that language work. Yeah.
What is meant by normal again?
Normal. Normal means that that A commutes with its A commutes with its adjoint. So Hermitian operators are normal. Anti-Hermitian operators are normal. Unitary operators are normal. These things are like Hermitian operators in that they have an eigenbasis, but their eigenvalues might be complex. Another way of saying this is you can write any operator as the sum of a Hermitian part and an anti-Hermitian part, and those things commute with each other if the operator is normal, and that means that the Hermitian part and the anti-Hermitian part can be diagonalized in the same basis.
and so that means that you can treat it in a very simple way. Lots of operators aren't normal. The raising and lowering operators in the harmonic oscillator aren't normal. But luckily, most of the things we want to deal with are. Okay, so with these words about convergence of the series, we're okay. We have we can make sense out of this, and in fact we can write this in terms of an energy eigenstate. So we have H n equals E n n. We have these are energy eigenstates. And so U of t, which is equal to e to the minus I h t over h bar, that's simply the sum over n of e to the minus I e sub n t over h bar n. It has the same eigenstates as h, but the eigenvalues are, I simply evaluate the function at those eigenvalues. and this is equal to sum over n e to the minus I omega n t n, as we said before, where omega n is equal to e sub n over h bar, as we saw. So everything's okay. What happens if we have a short interval of time? Call it delta. Then, in that case, we can say that U over that short interval of time is the identity, and we'll start writing out the terms of this exponential for the Hamiltonian minus I h delta over h bar plus terms of order delta squared, which very often we can ignore. Very often we can ignore. Okay. So this is a handy approximation for short intervals of time, telling me how things work. So. To summarize, we've got U of t. It's a one parameter family of unitary operators. It has U of 0 is equal to the identity. U of s times U of t is equal to U of s plus t. If we extend the range of t over all the real line, this does indeed form a group. It's a group. It's a one-dimensional group. And this group, this U of t family, is in a sense generated by the Hamiltonian, because I can get any one of them by simply exponentiating something linear in the Hamiltonian. And of course I can look at this for short times as well. Okay, so this is the prototype of a more general idea. So I want to talk about that idea in another context, this is a context you've probably already seen. So I'll go reasonably quickly, but of course, if I say something bizarre, you should slow me down. Or if I say something that you want to find out more about, you should slow me down. But I'm going to talk about rotation. So the idea here is that we might rotate a system about the z-axis. And for now, let's not think about what kind of system we're rotating. Rotate about the z-axis. Rotate the system. What do we have? We have some operator R that does it, that psi goes to psi prime, which is the rotation operator acting on psi. I'm assuming that this rotation operation doesn't involve any measurements of the system, and so preserves the superposition of states, and so is represented by a linear operator. And so for different angles, I'll have different operators. I can call that R sub z of alpha. Z represents the axis by which I'm rotating. Alpha represents the angle. Okay. And R z alpha is unitary, because the rotated state has to have the same normalization as the original state. A rotation about the z-axis by an angle 0 is the same thing as the identity operator. It doesn't do anything to the state. It doesn't change it in any way. Furthermore, if I compose two rotations about the z-axis, a rotation by alpha followed by a rotation by beta, I'll get a rotation by the sum of the two angles. That's R z beta times R z alpha, or you can write it the other way, because that still gives you the sum of the angles. And the point is that everything here is analogous to the situation in dynamics. Everything is analogous. It's exactly the same situation, except we're not necessarily thinking of things evolving in time. So what I want to do is I want to work out how this goes for a spin 1/2 particle. So, a spin 1/2 system. It's a kind of qubit. The dimension of the Hilbert space is 2, the simplest kind of Hilbert space that you can have. And so let me review just a few things about this. Everybody knows all about spin, but let's review. We have let's think about some basis states, which we could call up and down. It's an orthonormal basis for the set of spins. And there are one very useful thing are the Pauli operators. There's x, and I'm going to write these as matrix representations. I'm going to just write the matrix of matrix elements that I would get from this basis. And x looks like this, and y looks like this, and z looks like this. And the spin components, are 1/2 h bar times the corresponding Pauli operator for x, y, and z. Everybody, this look familiar to everybody? Okay, and so I can write down the eigenstates for these three Cartesian components of the spin, and their eigenstates with eigenvalues plus or minus 1/2 h bar for the spin components, or plus or minus 1 for the Pauli operators. And so what kind of eigenstates do I have? Well, I have z plus, which is in this this basis up, and z minus, which is down. Okay? And there's also, for example, x plus. And x plus turns out to be, x plus or minus, turns out to be 1 over the square root of 2 times up plus or minus down. These are the eigenstates of the x component of spin with eigenvalue plus or minus h bar. You also have, just for fun, we'll write these guys. These guys are also like that, except they're they have a complex phase up plus or minus I down. Okay. And the spin operators have commutation relations. We actually reminded you of the commutation relations of the spin operators in the tutorial assignment yesterday. For example, if I look at SX, SY, the commutator of SX X and SY, then I get I times H bar SZ. And if I cyclically permute X, Y, and Z, I get two other commutation relations which also hold. So my question, so this is what's going on with spin. Everybody happy with this? Has everybody seen this before? Good. Okay, good. What I want to know is how does a rotation about the z-axis by alpha affect the spin state? That's my question. How does that affect the spin state? Well, the first thing that I note is that the z-axis is unchanged. The z-axis is unchanged. When I physically rotate a system about the z-axis, I don't change my definition of the z-axis. And therefore, if my state started out an eigenstate of Sz, it should still be an eigenstate of Sz at the end. So the z-axis does not change. On the other hand, I can't say for sure that the state itself is not changed in any way. The state might change its phase. Now, if it's what I'm trying to say is that the eigenstates of this unitary operator of Rz alpha, these eigenstates are the z plus or minus states, the spin up and spin down states. And the eigenvalues, well, it's a unitary operator, and so its eigenvalues must be e to the I something real, and because it's a uniform family here that follows this composition rule, it must be the case that the eigenvalues are e to the I lambda plus or minus times alpha. In order for this phase has to be linear in alpha, so that when I compose operations together, I'll just get the sum here. So what I want to find out, and of course, the lambda plus goes with z plus, and lambda minus goes to z minus. And so what I need to know is what are lambda plus and lambda minus. Let me write this down over here. Rz alpha acting on z plus is equal to e to the I lambda plus alpha times z plus. And Rz of alpha z minus is equal to e to the I lambda minus alpha z minus. So this is what I've concluded here. I want to find out what lambda plus and lambda minus are. And I want this rule that I'm working out to work for any axis. I mean, we're thinking about the z-axis, but what's special about z? Nothing is special about z. If I rotate it around some arbitrary axis in the xy plane, I want the same kind of rule to hold. In particular, the same rule should apply to the z bar axis. That's the opposite to z. It's an axis that points just in the opposite direction as the z axis. It's really the same axis. Nope, that's not it. Very good. And let's think about that. What are the SZ bar eigenstates? Well, of course, Z bar plus or minus, that's just equal to Z minus plus. Okay? The Z bar plus eigenstate is the Z minus eigenstate. I'm just looking at the spin in the opposite spin component in the opposite direction. And I also want to tell you that a rotation about the z-axis by alpha is the same as a rotation about the z-bar axis by minus alpha. These are the same rotation in space. A rotation and the positive direction would be given by the right-hand rule. If the z-axis is pointing this way, that's a rotation by alpha. That's the same thing as a rotation by minus alpha about the opposite axis. Okay? And so, let's see how that works out. We want the same rule to apply, so we want a rotation by z bar by minus alpha acting on z bar plus. That's going to be e to the I lambda plus times minus alpha z bar plus. Okay? But this should be equal to a rotation by z about the a rotation about the z axis by alpha of the z minus state. And that's just equal to e to the I lambda minus times alpha acting on z minus. And so these two guys must be equal. How could those be equal? Well, z bar plus is the same as z minus. That's okay. I like that. But that means that these things have to be equal for any alpha. And the only way that can be true is if lambda plus and lambda minus are negatives of each other. So lambda minus is equal to minus lambda plus, and I'll just, instead of lambda plus, I'll just call that lambda. Lambda plus is just lambda. Okay, so far so good. This tells me that over here, I can change this a little bit. I can make that e to the I lambda alpha and e to the minus I lambda alpha for that one. Now I need to figure out what lambda is. Okay, so let's apply a rotation about the z-axis of pi over 2 to the state x plus. Well, let's think about the geometry of it. I'm looking down the z-axis. Here's the x and the y-axis. And so if I have a state that is x and y, okay. If I rotate this thing about the x-axis, if I rotate the state about the x-axis. The state was one where I had a positive spin in this direction, and I rotate it about the state about this direction. Then I should have something. Let's see if I've got this right. I'm rotating not the coordinates but the state, and I should get something like. Well, this looks like a mistake, but let's see if it works. The z-axis, let's see, x plus y is z. Okay, z-axis points this way. if I rotate in the positive direction, a positive alpha over 2, that means that my state, which is something like this, rotates around to that way. If I had previously a state with a positive, which was x plus, what should I wind up with? I should wind up with a state that has still has a definite component of spin along an axis, but the axis should now be that it has a definite spin along should be y plus. Is that right? Okay, we'll see how it works. I may have made a mistake in my notes. So what we expect is that Rz acting on pi over 2 should be something like y plus. I'm not really trusting this right at the moment, but let's go. But I don't know if it's equal to y over 2. There might be a phase. Okay, there might be a phase. I don't know. So let's actually do that. This is Rz alpha acting on 1 over the square root of 2 times z plus z minus. And that's equal to, this is pi over 2. That's equal to 1 over the square root of 2 times e to the I lambda plus times pi over 2 z plus e to the minus I lambda, this is minus I lambda pi over 2 z minus. Okay, that looks okay. All right, and that has to equal to something like that. That has to equal to 1 over the square root of 2 times e to the I phi z plus e to the I times phi plus pi over 2 z minus. And where do I get that? I get that from this, recognizing that I is equal to e to the I pi over 2. Okay? These two have to be equal. I got this from here. These two have to be equal. And that means that very quickly here, that lambda times pi over 2 should be equal to phi, and minus lambda times pi over 2 should be equal to phi plus pi over 2. And I take the difference of these, I get that lambda times pi is equal to minus pi over 2. Therefore, lambda is equal to minus 1 half. Lambda is equal to minus 1 half. And so that means that Rz of alpha acting on z plus is equal to e to the minus alpha over 2, I alpha over 2, z plus, and Rz alpha z minus is equal to e to the plus I alpha over 2, z minus. That tells me how to rotate a basis. Now, there's a remarkable fact here. This fact, this one half, has a really interesting significance. And I'm erasing my spin component, but I remember that my spin component acting on z plus and z minus gives me plus or minus one half h bar.
So I could therefore write this. I could therefore write this as rz alpha equal to simply e to the minus I sz alpha over h bar, the exponential of this operator. The sz gives me a plus 1/2 h bar or a minus 1/2 h bar, depending on whether I'm talking about the z plus or the z minus state. And you see, this is really, really, really analogous. To remind you, this would mean that e to the minus I sz alpha over h bar acting on z plus or minus will give me e to the minus plus or minus 1/2 h bar times alpha over h bar times z plus or minus, which would give me e to the minus plus I alpha over 2 z plus or minus, which is correct. Okay. So everything's just like the time evolution, including the fact that I can write this as an operator exponential of e to the minus I something times parameter over h bar, where the something is of physical interest. Except now, instead of being the Hamiltonian, the energy operator, it's the angular momentum operator. It's the angular momentum operator. Okay, well, that's pretty cool. Note something. A curious fact that I should mention is that a rotation by z about the z axis of 2 pi, what does that give me? Well, it gives me a minus 1 here because I have e to the minus I pi, and it gives me a minus 1 here. In fact, this rotation is minus the identity, which is curious because we'd expect a rotation by 2 pi, perhaps, to have something to do with, to be the identity. Yeah?
Lambda times pi over 2 equal to 5, but minus lambda times pi over 2 is 5 plus pi over 2.
Right. I wrote that here. E to the I phi times y plus is equal to 1 over the square root of 2 times e to the I phi times z plus e to the I phi multiplies both terms, e to the I phi times I z minus. Okay, that I comes from y plus, and so this e to the I is this. So here I have an e to the I phi plus 2 pi. And that factor has to equal e to the minus I lambda over 2. Okay, lambda pi over 2. So this I get from the z minus coefficient, and this I get from the z plus coefficient. Each of them has to be equal. Okay? All right. This curious fact, on the one hand, is completely inconsequential because, of course, if I multiply the state by a minus sign, I get a physically equivalent state. So on the one hand, I want to say this is completely inconsequential and don't worry about it. On the other hand, don't completely not worry about it because it turns out that this minus sign is one of the two most important minus signs in all of physics. The first important minus sign, of course, is the minus sign in the signature of space-time. In fact, there's a sign difference between space and time in Minkowski space. And this is the other one, because this minus sign that shows up in rotation is a consequence of this being a spin 1/2 system. And when you trace it through, this is the minus sign that's important in the relation between spin and statistics. This is the difference between bosons and fermions. And, you know, that's why there's, like, you know, stable matter and stuff. So it's also a very important minus sign. All right, so on the one hand, this is a really important minus sign, but for our purposes, we can just ignore it. It's, oh, yeah, it's a minus sign, but it's kind of funny. Okay, what else do I want to say? So in quantum theory,
In quantum theory, closing inspirational remarks here. In quantum theory, there are kind of two roles for operators. One of them is to describe observables. We generally have Hermitian operators describing observables. Okay? Observables like energy or angular momentum. They're described by operators, Hermitian operators. But the other role that operators play is state transformations, either evolution in time or how the state would change if you rotated or did some other kind of transformation. State transformations are also represented by operators. Those operators are typically unitary. And the two types of operators and the two roles that operators play are related by an exponential. That, in fact, that a unitary operator is e to the I Hermitian operator. This is generally true. Any unitary can be written this way. Any Hermitian generates a unitary when you take the complex exponential. And so we've seen a couple of examples of this. These guys are important in state transformations. These guys are important in observables. We've seen this in the case of time evolution, where this Hermitian operator was proportional to the energy times time. We've seen it now, and this was time evolution. We've seen it now in the case of rotation of a spin 1/2 particle, where this this Hermitian operator is proportional to angular momentum times angle. And this is the operator that accomplishes the rotation. So this is kind of a general pattern. And at the beginning of class next time, I'll give you a quick summary of how that might play out in general. Yeah?
This relationship that you envisioned is very similar to the one we see in group theory.
Well, of course, it's a group. And I'm going to let you fill in the group theoretic significance in your heads, because of course that's where all the important stuff is happening in this class. So, okay. All right. See you tomorrow. Why don't you see you this afternoon?